Tippett's Steal Away from A Child in Our Time, which closes today's InTune mixtape. The producer was Sophie Vilkins. You can find the details of all the music in today's mixtape on the Radio 3 website, and you can also download them to listen to wherever you are on the iPlayer radio app.
Five ancient tales of transformation.
I do love you. Almost as much as I love Xanthi the goose.
Oh, you?
The forbidden and the strange.
You seem changed somehow.
I am in love, Ferris.
What?
She's not alive.
What?
She's not dead. Or alive. She's something else.
Starting with a perilous journey.
Listen to me. Nothing will keep me from you.
Transformations. Five stories from Ovid's Metamorphoses.
You swear it?
I swear.
Next Monday to Friday night at 10:45, and then available on the Radio 3 website.
Good evening, I'm Chris Barrow, and now for In Concert. And tonight we're broadcasting the new production of Peter Bellamy's ballad opera The Transports, recorded live late last summer in a packed radio theatre here in Broadcasting House. The presenter is Verity Sharp.
Good evening and a very warm welcome to the BBC Radio Theatre. And tonight we're going to be hearing the recent, very highly acclaimed production of The Transports by Peter Bellamy. And when this was on tour back at the beginning of the year, everybody kept saying to me, have you seen The Transports? You have to see it. It's fantastic. Couldn't make any of the dates. So I'm really pleased personally that Radio 3 are hosting this special performance for us tonight. The cast includes a stellar lineup of people, some of the leading exponents of this country's folk traditional music scene. Nancy Kerr, Rachel McShane, Greg Russell, and also two of today's highly regarded groups, which is Faustus and the Young'uns. And this production of The Transports has been produced by the Young'uns, Michael Hughes. Peter Bellamy himself was a folk singer. He was very active around the folk clubs in the UK in the 1970s. He sung often unaccompanied because he was a great believer in the power of the tune and the words. And he had an instantly recognisable voice. Nasal is often used, reedy is often used, lots of vibrato and very loud. He really did belt the songs out. But his interest in folk ballads really stemmed from an interest in narrative. He was a great Kipling fan too. And The Transports was really a coming together of all of these interests. It's an opera of original ballads that was first recorded in 1977. So this is the 40th anniversary year of that. And it was a piece that brought him a lot of success, but in spite of that, sadly, a few years later, Peter Bellamy did take his own life. And in tonight's interval tonight, we're going to hear a little bit more about his very fruitful, if short, life. But for now, let's turn our attention to The Transports. The opera tells the tale of two people who were shipped to Botany Bay as part of the first ever transportations to Australia. And Bellamy carved from their story a tale of love, but also immense pain at them having to leave their homeland, which, of course, is very much still a current subject today. And that actually is something that tonight's production particularly focuses on. Bellamy's original score was just a series of ballads telling Henry and Susanna's tale, the two characters. But tonight, as you will hear, it's been reworked, not least to include a part for narrator, which is taken by Matthew Crampton, who's also done the writing. So Matthew, why did you write in a role for a narrator?
When I was asked to get involved with this production, the first thing I did was look at the story, find out how amazing it is. And then I thought, how can we bring this across? So I introduced spoken narration, threading through the songs, setting context for the songs, introducing the characters. And then I realised it's not just a story for 1784. It's a story for today. It's a story of vulnerable people being displaced and sent across the world by politics, by economics. And therefore, it is not only useful, but it is essential to provide that modern context.
So how did you knit in those contemporary stories?
We set up a project called Parallel Lives. And in every town where we perform the show, we find stories of people who've left the town, maybe in the 18th or 19th centuries, as migrants. And we counterpoint those with stories of people who've arrived in more recent decades. People come, people go, parallel lives. We also, in each town, link with a group that supports refugees or migrants. So that's how we weave a bit into it. But of course, this show is primarily one story, and that's the story of Henry and Susanna.
The music arranger of the original production was Dolly Collins, who was Shirley Collins' sister. And she was as much an exponent of early music as she was of folk music. So if you listen to that recording, it is very distinctive. But for this production tonight, the music arranging fell to Paul Sartin. Paul, did you take anything from Dolly Collins' originals?
Well, Dolly's arrangement is certainly iconic and inspiring. She wrote for an early music ensemble, as you say, and that we are not. We're folk musicians, so to most of us, written scores are anathema. So I went back to the original recordings and I just transcribed the melody lines and then started from scratch and arranged, really bearing in mind the individual musicians we have here. So I tried to leave them some space to do their own thing.
The actual tunes are all Bellamy's, is that right? He wrote all the original melodies.
Yes, he did. I mean, they're all traditional style, I suppose. And in fact, I think some people are quite surprised when they find out the tunes aren't traditional, but they were written in the 70s. We've incorporated one brand new song written by Sean Cooney of the Young'uns. And this is a modern song which we feel ties in very much with the theme of the original Transports and brings the whole show up to date and gives it a modern resonance in keeping with Matthew's texts.
Well, the cast of that original production featured an amazing lineup of talent. The Watersons, June Tabor, Nick Jones. But tonight we're going to hear an equally stellar lineup, as I said, of the current generation of leading British folk musicians. And in this first half, we're going to hear the voice of Sean Cooney singing the role of Henry Cable. Henry's parents are sung by Paul Sartin and Nancy Kerr. Rachel McShane is Susanna. David Eagle is Abe Carman. And Benji Kirkpatrick is the convict. The narrator is Matthew Crampton. And this is part one of The Transports by Peter Bellamy.
What a story we have for you this evening. It's the tale of a family destroyed and a family rebuilt. It's a tale of those who live at the bottom of the heap, the flotsam of the world, who little control their lives yet still grasp for joy. It's a tale of exile. It's a tale of migration, how history is shaped by the crossing of oceans by desperate people. And it's also a love story. And we all need love stories, don't we? But love comes at a price. And the price paid here is to be ripped from all you know and plunged into all that you fear. Let's head east. In fact, you travel Britain today. You can hear stories of exile and migration in every town. But our story comes from a Britain of over two centuries ago, when this island was a smaller, harder place, when most people in their lives never saw more than 10 miles from where they were born. They could scarce imagine what lay over the hills, let alone the other side of the world. Let's go east, as far as we can go, to the counties of Suffolk and Norfolk. Here is a land apart, in places so flat you cannot hide from the eye of God, and so low, so wet, you can be suddenly engulfed, whether by river, marsh, or sea. There's a fear of inundation here, and it rises where the counties meet along the River Waveney. Midway beside this flowing border, just south in Suffolk, lies a village called Mendham, once circled by marshes, still prey to rising waters. And in that village there lives a family called Cable, father, mother, and son Henry, a boy, soon to be a man. But all is not well with the Cables, for there is no work, and when there is no work, there is no food. The father bemoans the state. Once he would have traveled for employment, but now he is tied to his kin. He's a good man, but he's becoming desperate. And as he looks across the river into Norfolk, he can see rich houses for the picking. He's a good man, but he's a desperate man, and he's becoming tempted.
Oh, the times, they are hard, and the wages are poor. None of us poor fellows has money in store. So how can a good man keep the wolf from the door? Poor fellows, we all will go down. When work it is scarce, tell me, how can we eat? How can we afford to buy shoes for our feet? And how can we get clothing to keep off the sleep? Poor fellows, we might as well drown. If we could get labor, we never would complain. We'd work well for our master, his favor to gain. We'd be honest and faithful with never a stain. But poor fellows, how will we survive? We could plow the good land, we could fish the salt sea, we could work in the woodlands, felling all the trees.
But when only the
if no work is there, there's no manner of hardship that he cannot bear. Poor fellows, if he is alone, but a man with a family, his hands they are tied, he must look to their comfort or lose all his pride.
He can't wander away, but must stay by their side. Poor fellow, and maintain his home.
He's a good man, but he's a desperate man, and he's becoming tempted.
A man that is willing can't understand why. He can find no employment, how hard he may try. And it breaks his poor heart for to see his wife cry. Poor fellow, he'll do what he can. To sit home and sob.
Be he ever so honest, he'll turn out and rob. Poor fellow, to prove he's a man.
If a good man goes robbing, you know it's a shame. He brings scorn and misfortune on his honest name. But in pitiful straits, tell me, who is to blame? Poor fellow, you know he must try. So let's hope that these hard times, they soon pass away. Unto our sweet Savior we earnestly pray
that this dark cloudy morn brings a glorious day. Poor fellow, sometime ere he die.
That this dark cloudy morn brings a glorious day. Poor fellows, sometime ere we die.
If Henry's father was a good man, and he was a good man, then his father's friend Abe Carman was not. Abe needed no hardship to force him into a life of crime. He loved it. He lived for the thrill of theft, and he despised those who lived straight. There are plenty of ways to die boring, he'd say. Let me run free, let me steal free, till the day that I hang.
Oh, me name it is Abe Carman, and you might find me alarming if you think that there is harm in the trail of burglary. I live by taking chances like those heroes of romances, and by taking what I fancies from those wealthier than me. Yes, there are goods all for the taking, and there is no mistaking, there is little you'll be making on the straight and narrow path, like toiling for the masters and bowing to the pastors, those cruel, heartless bastards who would see a poor man starve. Old companions, I have seen them cast off all thoughts of freedom, as their wives and babies need them and the bread for which they slave. So their pride they learn to humble, being never heard to grumble. But before I take that tumble, you will find me in my grave. Some they goes to be a soldier with the muskets on their shoulder, but they never grows no older once the generals ride to war. And the lads who plough the ocean wish they'd never thought the notion, as commanders seek promotion on a tide as sailors go. As a robber, it seems only fitting that I should say to the band, come on, let's take it away! To steal, but let those who will bow under, like a man who hides some thunder. But as long as I can plunder, I will steer my course alone. No wife will ever mold me, no tyrant will control me, no bridewell door will hold me, and my soul will be my own. And so when the night comes falling, I'll attend unto my calling. You will never find me crawling to the lofty gentry with me pistols on the high road and me cudgels in the by road. Every road is my road when I walk it strong and free. Take it, lads!
I've a maid to hold a candle and a knight to break a handle and a lad to spy the land, and I will rob both great and small. To my lucky doom, forsake me on the day they come and take me, and on the gallows break me. Well, that will pay for all.
There's a saying amongst criminals, don't thieve too close to home. Put distance between you and your crime. Maybe Abe Carman thought it was enough to cross a river into another county. But the house that he chose to burgle, that of Mrs. Abigail Hambling, was only 2.5 miles away, almost neighbors. And you can't hide much from neighbors. So Abe and his 2 amateur accomplices went a-thieving. Henry stood guard while the older men rifled the house. Then, laden with their gains, they rode home. Such sudden wealth was swift, and it was easy. Now, there weren't many police in those days, so 18th century justice depended on 2 things. Firstly, informers. And it wasn't long till someone talked, and all three men were arrested and brought before the assizes at Thetford. And second, justice depended upon deterrent, for their crime of stealing some of Mrs. Hambling's furnishings and wine, all three men were sentenced to hang. That's what happened if you stole property back then. You were executed. It was swift. It was easy. But the system still allowed some mercy. So Henry's mother stood up in court. She knew she'd lost her husband, but maybe she could save her son. She begged for Henry's life, and she succeeded. The judge said Henry need not be hanged. Instead, he would be transported, taken away in chains to the other side of the world for 7 years, most likely never to return. So she saved her son, but her family is destroyed. And 3 weeks later, on a cold April morning, on the steep green hill beneath Norwich Jail, she watched her husband swing beside the man who led him to this fate. Maybe Abe Carman played to the crowd. People loved a hanging, and they loved a fearless exit. And Abe had boasted, "Till me luck it do forsake me, and on the day when they do take me, and on the gallows break me, and that will pay for all." It won't pay for her loss. She's lost her family, and now she curses the world. And she curses what once was good, like love and marriage. And she warns young women, don't get wed. All sorrows lie there.
Oh, the grass in the meadow, the reeds by the mere. The sad boom of the bittern is all that I hear. And the leaves in the by the shore cry. You never shall sit by your loved ones no more. You never shall sit by your loved ones no more. When I was a young girl, this world did seem but these cruel hard times do drive comfort away. And the leaves in the woodland and the gulls by the shore cry. You never shall dance with your sweetheart no more. You never shall dance with your sweetheart no more. Once I gathered wild flowers in the sweet countryside, but my garlands have withered, my posies have died. Shall walk with your men folk no more. You never shall walk with your men folk no more. Come all you young women that's free from all care, don't you ever only wild desolation is all I find there. I'll go down to the river to ease all my pain, and who knows but I might find my dear ones again. And who knows but I might find my dear ones again.
Henry sits in prison. He has little to look forward to except chains, maggots, and stink. Most criminals in Georgian England were either executed or exiled. Justice was about removal, not rehabilitation, and prisons were holding pens, temporary digs on the way to the scaffold or the transport ship. But Henry arrived at a strange new time, when these prisons were full to bursting. Traditionally, Britain transported its convicts to America. Ever since tiny Britain grabbed these huge overseas colonies, it needed the cheap labor, the free labor, to exploit those colonies. But this is 1784, and America has gone offline. The colonies have independence, and they're so gorged on African slaves, they have no need for refuse labor from Britain. But Britain has nowhere else to send its convicts, so the prisons keep filling beyond their capacity. Where does this lead? Well, we've seen where this might lead. Most prisons of the time were privately run. They existed to make profit. And profit means corners must be cut. Yes, we know where that leads. Just in these past few winters, we've seen riot in Bedford, Birmingham, Lincoln, Hull, and in Norwich Jail, 1784, it's the same story.
So early in the morning, the turnkey rings his bell. So early in the morning, we wish his soul to hell. So early in the morning, when the night begins to pale, we wonder if we'll ever see the last of Norwich Jail. The is foul, the air is bad, the company not choice. 'Twould make you scowl to hear that mad old turnkey's rasping voice. 'Twould make you wonder, would you ever live to tell the tale of the hardships and the miseries we've known in Norwich Jail? Our water here is scummy green, our beds is heaps of straw. There's water running down the walls and rats running on the floor. There's naught to eat but rotten meat that'd make a dog turn pale. Oh, it's great and broad and launching when you visit Norwich Jail.
So early in the morning the turnkey rings his bell. So early in the morning we wish his soul to hell. So early in the morning when the night begins to pale, we wonder if we'll ever see the last of Norwich Jail.
A concert, we rattles of our chains. And if we want a banquet, we drink sludge and call it ale. If you want a good time, commit a crime and come to Norwich Jail. Now, if you fancy gaming, the race is run by fillies. The stakes are perilously high, a crust of mouldy cheese. The first time that I tried me luck, I nearly lost me shirt. But lucky for me, they couldn't see the bugger for the dirt.
So early in the morning, the turnkey rings his bell. So early in the morning, we wish his soul to hell. So early in when the night begins to pale, we wonder if we'll ever see the last of Norwich Jail.
Well, if they'd sent us to America, today we would be free. But since the revolution, that land we'll never see. We are not for New England shore, 3,000 miles away. They say we're bound for further ground, and they've called it Botany Bay. Well, perhaps it's out by India, or maybe near Japan. Just off the coast of Canada, or in the hills of Spain. But wherever that strange land may be, we know it cannot fail to be a far, far better place than stinking Norwich Jail.
So early in the morning the turnkey rings his bell. So early in the morning we wish his soul to hell. So early in the morning when the night begins to pale, we wonder if we'll ever see the last of Norwich Jail. So early in the morning the turnkey rings his bell. So early in the morning we damn his soul to hell. So early in the morning when the night begins to pale, we wonder if we'll ever see the last of Norwich Jail.
Henry sits in jail, waiting to be removed from everything and everyone he's ever known. He might be thinking his life is over, but hey, his life is about to begin. For while in jail, he meets someone of similar age, similar situation. Both faced hanging, but were reprieved. Both now await transportation. And what's the name of this new friend? Susanna Holmes, yes, a woman. Norwich Jail in 1784 may seem an unlikely place to fall in love, but that's what happens. In time, Susanna will be voted one of the 11 most influential women in the history of Australia. But for now, she's an illiterate maid from Norfolk, and she's been caught stealing some spoons. Like Henry, she comes from the bottom of the social heap. But as a maid, her life had been different to his, for she's already been in prison. I mean, you can't blame her for choosing to enter service. Becoming a maid guarantees you something to wear, something to eat, somewhere to sleep. But there's a trade-off. In service, you surrender your freedom. A maid cannot marry. A maid must work every hour they are awake. They are a prisoner to the house that feeds them. Now, that may be bearable if you're desperate. But what if you're ambitious? What if you want more? Susanna wants more. She doesn't know what it is yet. How could she? She knows little of life outside her village, but she knows she wants to live. And to live, she must leave. And as a maid, if she wants to leave, she needs money. So she steals 2 silver spoons, and she has no regrets about what she's done and where it's led her.
So fine, I served her by night and by day. Oh, I carried the dishes while the lady would dine, and after I've cleared them away. Oh, dear me, how can it be the life of a servant is all slavery? I made up her bed and I turned down her sheets. I ironed the dresses she wore. Oh, I peeled her potatoes and roasted her meats. And twas I with my broom swept her floor. Oh, dear me, how can it be the life of a servant is all misery? I've scrubbed her front doorstep and I polished her plate. I put coal in the pan for her bed. Oh, I rose before sunlight to blacklead her grate. And at midnight I've laid down my head. Oh, dear me, how can it be the life of a servant is all drudgery? I've carried her water and I've answered her door. I've polished the shoes on her feet. Oh, and when she went to church, then her prayer book I bore behind as she marched down the street. Oh, dear me, how can it be the life of a servant a penance to me? Now I met a young man in the village one day. As I run to the shop for her bread, oh, he's asked me my name, but I had to away. Bless me mistress, she'd break me poor head. Oh, dear me, how can it be the life of a servant has no liberty? So that night as I lay in my attic so bare, I resolved that I would run away, oh, and all for to honour the wagoner's fare, some silver spoons took for me.
So for stealing some spoons, Susanna is sentenced to death, reduced to 14 years transportation. But in prison, she's happy. She's no longer a maid, and she's got company.
Now I lie in prison, but I will not weep. Who knows what tomorrow may hold? Oh, there's some fine lads in here for me company to keep. They're strong arms for to keep me. Confinement for most of me years. Small freedom did I ever get? Oh, some prison, sure they have no cold iron bars, but some prisons, why they have no men. Oh, dear me, how can it be the life of a convict's a pleasure to me?
Susanna regrets little, and in Norwich jail she meets Henry, who knows little. Both have lost their families, both their lives are on hold, but together they can imagine new lives, new family. They sit amidst the darkness of their cell. They gaze up at the window high above, and they dare to dream of a world beyond.
If you look out from some high, high window, you will see the sunset beyond the town. You will see the rocks to the treetops screaming, and the wing of evening comb folding down. Between the morning and the evening, between the springtime and the winter dream, there comes a time of new beginnings, when sweet love in friendship drives away all fear. There is many here, they know not but sorrow, and like the beast they live from day to day. But we can think on a bright tomorrow, since sweet love in friendship drives all grief away. All hope in prison it soon will smother, if none will with you your sorrow share. But we cling fast to one each other, and sweet love in friendship banishes despair. Just like the sailor when his ship makes harbour, just like the traveller who finds an inn, what care they if the wind blows harder, when they'd be safe and warm within? No lonely can resist the darkness, just
life in vain. Bullet, find a comrade for to share your fastness, and sweet loving friendship will ease your pain. So if you look out from some high, high window and see the sunset beyond the sky, you need not mourn at the coming shadow. If some loving friend is standing nigh.
Ah. Year passes year, and this young couple enjoy an unusual freedom in jail. They can live together. They can lie together. In 1786, the hellish limbo of this jail is disrupted by a different kind of scream. It's that of their baby boy. These orphans of justice have made a new family. Meanwhile, 120 miles away in London, prison hulks are backing up in the Thames. The establishment are scared. They've always feared being engulfed by the mob. And now they have reason to fear. The French Revolution is but 3 years away, and in Britain, the prisons are overfilling, and there's a whiff of revolt in the air. Whitehall looks desperately for somewhere else to send its convicts. It considers places like Madagascar, Cape Town, the Gambia, but none seem right. For quite simply, white convicts don't survive in Africa. At this point, the officials receive a visit from a certain James Matra, a man who once sailed the world with Captain Cook. And he's brought a map, and he's got an idea.
This may be a bold notion, but I remember back in 1770, we saw somewhere that may be fit for your purposes. Botany Bay, we called it. Well, we didn't stay long, but it seemed fertile and fit for human settlement.
Maybe we should take a look, said the officials.
Are you in a hurry?
Yes.
That may be a problem. Takes 18 months to get there and back, and, well, you might not actually get back.
So you're saying that we should send thousands of chained convicts, plus their guards, plus all that's needed to create a penal colony from scratch, the tools, the supplies, the tradesmen, the administrators, to an unknown rock, 10,000 miles away, which one ship has seen once for a few days 17 years ago.
Yes. And it's more like 15,000 miles. Well, this was madness. A wild gamble.
This was madness. It was a wild gamble. But they did it. And plans started for the first fleet to New South Wales. 11 ships, 736 convicts, 578 soldiers and civilians, and all that was needed to create a penal colony from scratch. Just a small portion this was of the prison population, but it was a start. Then someone thought, maybe a bit late, that if you're creating a society, it seems crazy to do that simply with men. So word went out to gather female prisoners, and a letter reached the governor of Norwich Jail naming three women convicts who must be hastened to Plymouth to join the fleet. One of those named was Susanna Holmes. But there was no mention of Henry Cable. Henry begged that they might marry in prison, but a wedding in jail was a liberty too far for the governor. So Susanna was taken away with the baby. So now, having lost his first family, Henry's next family is being ripped from him too. The woman whose love sustained him in jail, the child which offered hope of a new life. Maybe his mother was right. It's better not to love in the first place. He sits sad within his cell and sings a lament for those who have lost everything.
It is cold, sad, and lonely in this dismal cell. No solace comes up with a day. My heart knows an anguish that no tongue can tell, for they've taken my true love away. Oh, the black and bitter night, and oh, the weary day. My love has been snatched far, far from my sight, and the transports will bear her away. When first to this prison so deep was my pain, then she came and she banished dismay. But now in despondence I'm drowning again, for they've taken my true love away. Though surrounded by horrors, yet we found delight. For where love is, no sorrow can stay. But misery and squalor swim back to my sight. Now they've taken my true love away. All the black and bitter nights, and all grasses still grow, and the streams still downflow, and the blackbird still sings on the spray. But in dank, dreary dungeons, there is nothing but war when they've taken your true love away. But if I were a seagull, I'd fly to her side, and it's there that I wish I could stay. But soon the cruel prison ship leaves with the tide, and it's bearing my true love away. And if I were a herring, I'd wait by the slip, though I waited a year and a day. And through the wide ocean, I'd follow the ship that is bearing my true love away. Black and bitter nights, and all the weary day. My
the transport will bear her away.
So lovers, cling fast to each pleasure you find, and cherish each moment of play. For all you will have will be what's in your mind once they've taken your true love away. Oh, the black and bitter night, and all the weary day, my love has been snatched far, far from my sight, and the transport will bear her away. Oh, the black and bitter night, and all the weary day, my love has been snatched far, far from my sight, and the transport will bear her away.
And so Henry, Susanna and their child are forced apart, with Susanna now on her way to Plymouth and soon to Botany Bay. That's the end of the first part of The Transports by Peter Bellamy. First recorded in 1977, reworked this year by the writer Matthew Crampton, who you're hearing as the narrator, and Bellamy's music as arranged by Paul Sartin. Henry is sung by Sean Cooney and Susanna by Rachel McShane, and they are flanked by Nancy Kerr, Greg Russell and the respective members of Faustus and the Young'uns. Well, we're going to continue that story in about 20 minutes' time, but for now, during the interval, let's hear more about The Transports and the life of its creator, Peter Franklin Bellamy, art school dropout, composer, musician and highly distinctive folk singer.
When I was young and scarce 18, I drove a roaring trade, and many a sly trick have I played on many a pretty maid.
He was almost sort of mythical character to me, really. People talked about him in sort of hushed undertones, and he was very enthusiastic.
He was completely unlike anybody else I'd ever heard, and very mannered in a way, and he was a bit like Marmite. People either loved him or loathed him, but he just gave it everything he had and would go for the extreme notes and the exciting aspects of the song without hesitation.
Peter was an absolutely electrifying performer. He absolutely adored traditional music. He loved people's music.
Now when first I put my foot on board, how I did stand and stare.
On Board the 98, the song with which Peter Bellamy started every concert. Words collected in Norfolk by Ralph Vaughan Williams and set to a belter of a tune by Bellamy himself. It's a voice that's hard to forget, and it belongs to a man who clearly touched the lives of many.
On Board the 98.
I think he's a funny mix, because there's the kind of very traddy kind of side to him, so very kind of uncompromising in some respects musically, you know. He never did a prog rock crossover. But on the other hand, his presentational style was very exuberant and very theatrical, and there was none of this, I'm just going to stand on the stage with my arms by my side and just sing it and let the music do the talking, because he was a complete showman, you know. So, yeah, I'm really drawn to that sort of theatrical side of his performance, definitely.
Rolled by, and at Trafalgar, brave Nelson, he fought and fell.
It upset a lot of people who really wanted folk music to be, you know, sitting around in somebody's kitchen. We thought, no, it's an act.
Mm.
It's a performance.
Save my pay, they'd only knocked a wing off Jack on board in 98.
You heard there the memories of Damien Barber, Jenny Bellamy, Martin Carthy, John Bowden and Heather Wood. Peter Bellamy rooted himself in North Norfolk, growing up in a stiff military household, his father a farm bailiff. Interestingly, though, as a teenager, Peter enrolled at art school, where he was taught by Peter Blake, co-creator of the cover to the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, and a man that Bellamy never forgot. But even then, Peter Bellamy was wrestling with demons, and, encouraged by his friend Anne Briggs, left art college to try and better express himself in song. He teamed up with Heather Wood and Royston Wood, two similarly gregarious people with an ambition to bring some flamboyance to the tradition, and together they formed a powerful unaccompanied trio called the Young Tradition. Heather has lived in the US for 40 years now, but still clearly remembers when she first met Peter.
Yes, 18th of April 1965, I walked into the Scots House at Cambridge Circus, which is now the Spice of Life, and Pete and Royston were singing together, doing Copper Family songs. And I thought, that's fun.
How did he strike you?
Tall, blonde, outrageous clothes. Royston had serious mutton chop sideboards at that point. I don't remember what Peter's facial hair was. Eventually, we ended up singing together, and then people started saying, can we book you? We'll you know, pay you. And we said, ooh. OK.
I'm looking at a photograph of you, Heather, from 1968. Peter in his floral flares, you with these incredible plaits right down to your waist and this long...
Yes, unfortunately they're false. I still have them.
Oh, brilliant.
They don't match the hair anymore.
And then Royston's in a kind of dinner jacket and stuff. I mean, you're out there, aren't you?
Yes, that's what we did.
Self-consciously very stylish. That's how they presented themselves. They were very effective on stage.
Pretty Nancy of Yarmouth, she's my own nuts delight.
They sang very straightforwardly, and they were a foil for the Watersons. There was a loving rivalry between them. I mean, they got on like a house on fire. Who wouldn't get on with Peter? Or Royston, for that matter, or Heather. She was a grumpy old bugger, still is. But she's a good singer.
On the 18th of October, our barket set sail. Pretty Nancy, come down for to bid me farewell. She said, while you're sailing on the white waste of blue, she said, my young sailor, I'll be faithful to you.
There were a lot of big concerts back then. I mean, we played the Royal Albert Hall and the Royal Festival Hall and the Queen Elizabeth Hall and the Wigmore Hall and the Jeanette Cochran Theatre and Liverpool Cathedral and various other places like that, with all the other people who were professionally singing at that time, like the Ian Campbell Group and the Spinners. What happened to us in America, the first year we were over there, we were at the Newport Folk Festival, back in the days when it had a lot of really good traditional performers. And it was the first year they decided not to amplify the workshop stages. So people would come off the main concert and then they'd be scattered around the field, these little stages, with no mics. And of course, we'd never seen a microphone at that point. So we were just making our usual excessively loud noise. And all the poor little Americans were singing into their sound holes and not being heard. So we got all the audience and all the attention. It was great.
But it wasn't to last. In 1969, the Young Tradition, who were perhaps the first group to ever bring a rock music attitude to folk without any need for amplification, split up. But their approach, treating traditional songs with respect but not reverence, continued to define Bellamy's career as a solo performer. With his first album, he laid out his stall very clearly by calling it Mainly Norfolk.
One morning in the month of June, down by a riverside, a lady spied a bold fisherman come rowing on the tide.
His commitment was to the music of his own county and to those who'd been treasuring the traditional songs thus far, source singers like farm labourer Walter Pardon, someone who Peter made a point of visiting and recording regularly.
Morning to you, bold fisherman, How came you fishing here? I came a-fishing for your sweet sake, all on this river clear.
When I first met him at this festival in Great Cressingham, he just battered me with information about the folk scene. I think he was excited that I was 18 years old, a young folk singer, singing traditional folk songs with a concertina. I didn't have a band or anything. He was very excited that there was someone else doing that.
Damien Barber is this generation's flag bearer when it comes to the traditional music of Norfolk, and someone to whom Peter Bellamy gave almost overwhelming support.
It was literally maybe a couple of weeks later when I ended up getting a big parcel. It was a collection of bootleg cassette tapes that Peter had put together of all the material from the three main source singers from Norfolk,
wow,
who was Harry Cox, Sam Larner and Walter, Walter Pardon. I had no idea it was coming, but it was written a Norfolk folk singers beginner's kit, and a big letter from Peter saying, you know, basically, if you're going to start singing, if you're going to sing traditional songs, you need to go back to the source, which was these three Norfolk singers.
He was an incredibly generous person.
Peter Bellamy's wife, Jenny.
When people came to stay and they came to visit, he would play the music, that he would listen to what they'd been singing or doing, and he'd play them what he thought they would enjoy. He'd make tapes for them, and he was just an incredibly generous-hearted man. Mm. He collected cassette tapes, and wherever he was staying with people, he would have blank tapes in his bag, and he'd go on poaching exercises and collected probably about 1,000 audio tapes.
And that was all in the quest to find the good songs?
No, some of it was just the music he loved. He rarely listened to folk music. He had a large collection of source singers, and when he was looking for new songs, he would go back to source singers and research the original of the song and then craft it and make it his own. But his song influences were vast, from opera to blues to jazz, scat, Rolling Stones. He was a massive Rolling Stones fan. Bob Dylan. He just loved good music.
Come all you young fellows, wheresoever that you be, I will have you pay attention and listen unto me.
And yet his own style was very much incredibly kind of strict, really, it sounds anyway, traditional way of singing, which is quite surprising. You would have thought he would have drawn on some of those influences.
Well, I think he did, because the way he sings is so utterly out on the edge. And he would be listening to something and he'd say, wow, I wonder where that came from. Ella Fitzgerald was on and there was something she sang and he went, hang on a minute, that's where I got that from. And then he sang me a little phrase from a song that he'd recently, which was a traditional song, which he'd recently made his own. And there it was, this nuance of song which he'd got from Ella Fitzgerald. So his influences were absolutely countless.
I never had dealings with her in me time. It's a thing to hang for another man's crime.
As another measure of that breadth and independence of mind, Peter Bellamy became an advocate of the work of Rudyard Kipling. But this was the early 70s, when Kipling was generally judged as a jingoist, whose work in a post-colonial era was of little value. But Peter Bellamy was paying more attention. He was reading Kipling's Barrack Room Ballads and recognising them for what they really were, poems that gave voice to the voiceless, the ordinary soldiers, who in reality showed great contempt for those who'd sent them off to die. Bellamy also saw that these poems were musical, wondering if Kipling had in fact written them as songs. Rumour had it he whistled as he worked. So in 1973, Bellamy started giving them tunes. And this year, in another example of the resurgence of interest in Bellamy's work, many were presented in a concert at Hartlepool Folk Festival. Damien Barber.
The songs that I was singing, and in fact all the songs, they very much come from the poor soldier's point of view. I mean, I was singing the Private Ortheris's song about a lad who's really got not much choices in his life. And every choice that he makes seems to be the wrong one, and that's how he ends up fighting on the front line for the British Empire.
I fired a shot at an Afghan, the beggar, he fired again. And I lay on me bed with a hole in my head, and I missed the next campaign. Well, I up with me gun at a Burman who carried a blooming dart, but the cartridge stuck and the bayonet broke, and all I got was the scar.
One of the songs I was singing was The Road to Mandalay. It's just a beautiful song about a time when soldiers were being shot left, right and centre, and armies were suffering from cholera and all sorts of diseases in trenches, and they were doing horrible things to people in foreign countries. The one thing that this guy takes away from him is this chance meeting with a local girl in India. It's just a very romantic sort of look back at his experience.
The rice fields and the sun was sinking low. She'd get a little banjo and she'd sing "Ooh-la-lo-lo" with her arm upon me shoulder and her cheek again my cheek. We used to watch the steamers and the Afghans piling teak.
When he wasn't performing, you would find him in the quietest pub in the town with all the daily papers, the Times, the Guardian, the Telegraph, sitting in a corner doing the crosswords.
So was it almost like the songs did give him an armour?
Well,
you know, a costume with which to perform through?
It did, and he very much lived behind a palisade. Bravado, a stage presence, which he lived behind and in a way prevented people from getting too close. He was very shy. Apart from going out and doing gigs and going to festivals, he didn't go out and socialise much. He far preferred people to come and visit him because he was safe in his own environment. When he went shopping, he would put on his headphones and have his Walkman and listen to music all the way so that he wasn't really communicating with the world. And he was very much a homebody and he liked to be at home.
At home in 1973, reading the local paper, he came across the true story of Susanna Holmes and Henry Cable, two petty criminals holed up in a Norfolk jail who had a child and were later deported to Australia. For Bellamy, it was the narrative gold dust that would give him his ideal plot for his folk opera, The Transports.
Peter was incredibly fired up by it. I talked to him on the phone several times about it.
Then he decided which friends of his in the folk world he wanted to sing the different parts. He then wrote the song for that person. And then he wrote the songs in 4 days and nights.
Wow.
The whole thing was written in a matter of days. He didn't go to bed, just wrote all the way through.
Then he suddenly rang up one day and he said, there's extra parts, so I have to have you. We were great friends. I've got to have you. You're playing the coachman. I said, oh, OK. Really? No, you're not the coachman at all. You're the human turkey. Beg your pardon? The humane turkey. But I always call you the human turkey. I said, thanks, Peter. I said, so I've got a song for you.
He knew, for instance, that Mike Waterson had this massive range and he wrote The Black and Bitter Night, which is one of the best-known songs probably from The Transports, which goes incredibly high and incredibly low. And he knew Mike Waterson could sing that and it was specifically written for Mike. And every song in The Transports was written for the person who originally sang it.
His favourite musician was Dolly Collins, Shirley's sister. She did all these arrangements. She had a particular way of arranging that Peter loved, which used early instruments.
Is what stays in your mind once they're taken between them.
The whole thing was a smashing success in the end.
In the end, because it took 4 years for Peter Bellamy to see The Transports realised, first as a double LP that became Folk Album of the Year. Its scale and ambition ensured The Transports became something of a milestone in English folk music.
I think The Transports was an extraordinary achievement in its own sort of compositional terms, but also it's had such a huge impact on the scene.
John Bowden.
you want an introduction to the English folk scene, that's the album to listen to, because the vocal performances on that by June Tabor and Nick Jones and Martin Carthy, it's like a roll call of the great singers of the revival. And it's a real testament, I think, to, you know, the respect that he commanded and the affection that he commanded, but also just the creative triumph that is the Transports, that they were all involved, and that ever since, such wonderful musicians have been drawn to reimagining it and re-performing it.
I was his agent for a while, and I'd spend evenings on the phone speaking to club organisers, with Peter sitting opposite me across the table. In the end, I said, you know, you've just got to go into another room because you can't sit there with your head in your hands.
By 1977, the folk scene had changed. Punk had arrived, shattering the musical landscape, and despite the huge success of the Transports, Bellamy's diary remained empty.
Club organisers say, well, will he come and do a floor spot? And I said, well, he did his floor spots in the 60s. It was really, really difficult. He was despairing.
Becoming increasingly broke, he began to descend into depression. But this wasn't the only reason.
They went out onto the veranda and they sat out staring into the St. Louis night. Nick said there was this huge long silence. And suddenly Peter said into the darkness, my father was a Nazi.
And he was. Peter's father was Richard Raynell Bellamy, leader of Oswald Mosley's Black Shirts in Manchester and author of We Marched with Mosley.
Being heavily involved in the folk scene, with its very left-wing sort of leanings, folk clubs came from communist clubs, and having come from a very right-wing sort of upbringing, I suspect he was quite confused politically. I don't think he did talk about politics much, to be honest.
There's no suggestion that Peter shared his fascist views. If anything, he was apolitical. But it's certainly another significant fact in the complex layers that shaped Peter Bellamy, making him the defiant, if lonely, figure that he was. He was a man of great humanity, but clearly wasn't always easy.
I think when Bellamy came out with these Kipling settings, a lot of people were like, what on earth are you doing, you know? And I think Peter just found the sort of assumption that everything had to be left-wing problematic. And I think he liked being argumentative and he liked causing a bit of a stir. So, you know, I think he did set people against him almost deliberately, I think.
He saw other performers having much better careers than he had, and he couldn't understand at all why this was their lot and this was his lot. He couldn't understand that at all.
It is a very sad story that he did ultimately take his own life. I mean, was that the reason why?
I think that was partly the reason. I think the other part was lack of self-worth, which came through in his emotional security as well as in his professional insecurity. He didn't feel as if he was loved, wanted or appreciated. And that included by me. He felt as if I was putting up with him and wasn't aware of the fact that he was loved. He didn't know what it looked like. It was terribly hard. Mm. If I went away to go to see my mum for the day, or I went away, I was in a Morris dance team, so if I went on a dance weekend, he would stay at home. He would record every programme that he wanted us to watch so we could watch it together.
Wow.
And it was as if when I went out of the door, he lived in a deep, dark pit and I owned the ladder.
Peter Bellamy took his own life in 1991, and many people to this day feel they should have seen it coming. Shock and sadness ricocheted through the folk world, but also, I think, guilt. Bellamy was a man who'd really ploughed his own furrow, forever answering back and breaking the rules. And yet he was utterly faithful to the tradition, not just preserving it, but adding to it with new songs and tunes.
Some good words in here, watch out.
He was a remarkable innovator, and thankfully, increasingly over the years, the world is waking up to that.
I do not look for holy saints to guide me on my way, nor for male and female devilkins to lead my feet.
I think Bellamy's reputation is secure with the younger generation of folkies. I think his name is now in that kind of pantheon of people you need to know about, in a way that it wasn't actually 15 years ago, maybe. I think that Or certainly, if it's not there now, I think it will be after this revival of the Transports. I think it's quite a significant moment, I think, in Bellamy's afterlife, if I can call it that. I think that's going to have a real impact on other young singers coming through.
And when they do me random wrong, as often times has been, I will not cherish hate too long.
I think that the iconoclastic singer that he was has really appealed to a new young generation of singers. And I think he's gained a new focus and following because he wasn't run-of-the-mill. He was never run-of-the-mill.
For as we give and as we take, whatever our takings be, the people, Lord, thy people are good enough for me. So I...
One of the biggest legacies for me personally is the discovery and support of Walter Bardon. Without Peter, Walter would have sat in his house. No one would have known about him. People have collected, recorded over 180 or so songs from Walter, and many of those songs had never been recorded by anybody else. They would be gone. From a legacy point of view, you've got Peter's songs, you've got Peter's recordings, you've got the Transports, you've got the Kipling stuff. His passion and his devotion to the folk scene and to folk music. Peter is certainly one of the major influences in my life.
The people, Lord, thy people are good enough for me.
Good enough for me.
Peter Bellamy singing his setting of A Pilgrim's Way by Rudyard Kipling. And now let's return to the BBC Radio Theatre for the second half of Peter Bellamy's ballad opera The Transports. In this recent production featuring Nancy Kerr, Greg Russell, Paul Sartin, Benji Kirkpatrick, Saul Rose, Rachel McShane, David Eagle, Michael Hughes and Sean Cooney. Matthew Crampton is the narrator. And the first song in this second half is the only one in this production that isn't, in fact, one of Bellamy's originals. It's been written by Sean Cooney of the Young'uns, and it tells a contemporary story of forced migration.
Sometimes you have to dive straight into what frightens you most. Hesham Modamani was on the run from government thugs in Damascus. He got as far as western Turkey, but then his path was blocked by the sea. Only 5 miles of sea, but no boat could cross it undetected. And the water was cold. It was dangerous. It was dark. If it was safe to swim across, then surely someone would have tried. But Hesham and his friend Ferus have no choice. They cannot return to Syria. But neither can they afford any other way to go on. So one night in late spring, they stuff their papers, their money, their mobile phones, their chargers into watertight bags. They seal the bags. They put them round their necks and they step carefully into the dark water. They spend 5 hours in that water, dodging patrols, watching as birds of prey eye them from above. And in one strangely joyful moment, Hesham swims onto his back, looks up at the stars, and for the first time in so long feels at peace. But then, midstream, the waves now towering over them, Hesham realizes he can swim no more. Death beckons. Could this be another anonymous drowning in the Eastern Mediterranean?
The night was dark, the night was long. We swam in the sea. On my lips was a song. Dark water, carry me.
We couldn't pay the smuggler's fare, nor fly above the sea. We had to swim to make it there. Dark water, carry me. Tie your fawn around your chest, my friend said to me, and tie your shoes around your neck, dark water, carry me. And off we swam, and the sea was calm, and how we smiled with glee, for our smiles kept us warm. Dark water, carry me. I turned and swam on my back, and the stars fell on me, and I've not felt peace like that. The stars, the sea, dark water, carry me. Dark water, carry me. Dark water, carry me. But soon the waves came wild and high, and then ravens, they came to see. Fresh corpses drifting by. Dark water, carry me. But we will reach the other side. My friend promised me, this black tide. Dark water, carry me. I saw light and I heard a cry, felt two arms holding me. I've not felt joy like that, pulled from the sea. Dark water, carry me. Dark water, carry me. Dark water, carry me. But in my dreams, it's not the same, for I am the same. A million voices sing my name. Dark water, carry me.
Eshed Modamani survived. He made it to Germany. Last week, Sean met him in Berlin. And together with Michael and David of the Young'uns, they sang him the song, Dark Water. Travel Britain today, you can hear stories of exile and migration in every town. We were in Shrewsbury 3 days ago. There we learnt the story of a young man called John Bennett. He was on the same ship as Henry and Susanna. But when he reached Botany Bay, just 4 months later, he was caught stealing some food and he was hanged. He was 17 years old. As he stood trembling on the gallows, he confessed his wickedness. He was 17. Was he rotten through and through, like Abe Carman in our story? Or more likely, was he naive and desperate, like Henry and his father? In Shoreham, on the south coast, we heard a story that haunts me still. It told of two teenage girls, Sophia Clifton, Olive King. Maybe they'd been orphaned, maybe they'd been abandoned. Either way, they ended up in the Brighton workhouse. And then they appeared before the Sussex Assizes. They'd stolen some clothing. The clothing was worth 4 shillings. For this, these two teenage girls were transported for 14 years to Australia. And on arrival there, the dark purpose of this policy was soon made apparent. For immediately, they and all the other women convicts on board were advertised, effectively for sale, for providing free labor in local farms and businesses. And being unmarried, they were forced to wed convicts who had served their term. This was 1839. 3 decades earlier, Britain had abolished the Atlantic slave trade. Yet here, officially, there is a policy of trafficking comfort brides to the colonies. People go, people come, parallel lives. In Derby, we met Milad Arbash from Syria. He'd been on one of those boats. The crowded, flimsy inflatables, 300 on board, the boat went down, 30 went down with it, he survived. He made it to Derby. Within a month, he was working at Marks and Spencer. Ayad Zinna, a dentist from Damascus, he paid $2,000 for the honor of being abandoned upon an overcrowded raft, which he survived. He made it to Dover, then to London, and he found himself working in Starbucks. Patricia Nganga, a nurse from Congo Brazzaville. Her mother was a chemist. Her mother was murdered by the government. Patricia escaped. She managed to cross the whole of Africa. And then she managed to cross the Mediterranean. And then she managed to cross Europe. And she went across Britain too. She ended up in Glasgow, where she works to help other refugees. As does Camila Itura, who fled Pinochet's thugs and finally joined the Chilean community in Cambridge, where she too helps people who have arrived recently. And there's another story I always remember. This was a story of a group of young men from Eastern Europe who were making their way westwards across mainland Europe. They hid by day, sleeping in forests. They traveled by night. They were hunted by police and army. They couldn't trust civilians. They thought Paris might be safe, but it wasn't. So they headed north, up to the coast. They aimed for Britain. The crossing of the Channel was difficult, it was dangerous. They made it. The year? 1940. They were pilots from the Polish Air Force. And with their homeland overrun, they had fled to find a country that would give them planes with which they could fight back. And when they reached Britain, tired and dirty, the RAF, as soon as it saw their skills, gave them planes. Formed them into a squadron, and the squadron was based in Exeter, and it was known as the Night Owls, And from there, these Polish airmen through the Second World War protected the coasts and towns of the Southwest against nighttime attack. And after the war, many of them settled in the town. As Hesham said to Sean last week, I may be a refugee, but that does not define me. I have work to do and a life to live. History has always been shaped by the crossing of oceans by desperate people. Yes, such migration is rooted in pain. Yes, it can create disbalance where it lands. But migration also provides nutrients like youth and energy, essential for aging societies like ours. And whether people like it or not, it is inevitable. Yet we live in fearful times. Nazis march proudly down American streets. In Europe, borders are closing faster than at any time since the 1930s. Fear appears to be winning. What can we do? Maybe we can tell stories. Maybe by putting a face on migration, by showing how our own past is shaped by such transit, then maybe, just maybe, we can help to detoxify that debate. And talking of stories, it's time now to return to Henry and Susanna. And it's time to meet our hero. Oh dear. His name is John Simpson. He's a turnkey, a jailer from Norwich, and he's been given a horrible task. He has to escort three women prisoners and a baby all the way from Norwich to Plymouth, 350 miles, in chains, on the back of an open coach, in November. It's a terrible trip. And as soon as they reach Plymouth, he rushes them down to the docks to find their allotted ship. So far, he's not yet been heroic.
Come, rise you up, John Simpson. The governor did say these scum are chained and ready, and it's time you was away. Three women and a farthing child to Plymouth they are bound, and you must be their escort till they reach that distant town. When me and these poor convicts did arrive at Plymouth Strand, I marched them up all onto the deck, all chained hand to hand. The captain saw us come on board, and he did prove unkind. The women come, he did declare, but the infant stays behind. This proud, unfeeling seaman, Captain Gilbert was his name. Oh, to see a babe abandoned so, I swore it was a shame. I wrapped it up in me great coat, to the coach I went straightway, and I started out to London town without no more delay.
So the nasty Captain Gilbert refuses to take the infant because its name is not upon his list. Susanna is dragged away screaming that she'll kill herself, and Simpson is left holding the baby. 5 minutes ago, he was all set to return to Norwich free. Now he's lumbered. What can he do? Well, what often happened is that the jailer would find a sack, some stones, and a quiet part of the dock. Or he would leave the child in the nearest workhouse. But Simpson remembers our hero. He doesn't drown or dump the baby. Instead, he says, damn it, justice must be done. And he takes the baby with him, not to Norwich, but to London, for he knows that that's the only place where he can get justice. But he'll have to hurry, for the fleet is getting ready to sail. Now, this is 1784. How long do you think it would take to go from Plymouth to London, 200 miles. There's no M5. There's no M4, just muddy turnpikes. There's no streetlights for these long, dark days of winter. Well, the fastest option available to Mr. Simpson was that remarkable people carrier, the Plymouth Mail. This raced along, stopping only to change horses every 10 miles. And it reached London, incredibly, in only 40 hours. With six on top, four inside, and a guard on the back with a blunderbuss, battling wind, rain, highwaymen and stray sheep. There was one man who ensured the mail got through on time. The king of the road, the coachman of the Plymouth Mail.
And the whip goes crack and the horn does blow. The turnpike calls and I must go. No wind, no sleep, no rain, no hail. We'll halt the driver of the Plymouth Mail. When I was a lad, I used to play by the roadside all the livelong day, hoping always to espy the gentry's coaches a-rolling by. When I was a youth, I used to roam with a wagoner from town to town. But I long to fly across this land, a stagecoach high with a four in hand. And now I've grown unto a man, the driver's box I take my stand. Like the captain bold of a ship in sail, and a man who drives the Plymouth Mail. And the whip goes crack and the horn does blow. The turnpike calls and I must go. No wind, no sleet, no rain, no hail. We'll halt the driver of the Plymouth Mail. With six on top and four inside, the post boy and the guard beside, their bags and baggage safely stored, for it's time we hit the open road. Then the hooves do fly and the wheels spin round. We bid adieu to Plymouth town. Plympton, Brent and Ashburton pass, and to Exeter we come at last. Then the horses blow and the sides do steam. The ostlers run to change the team. And the travellers drink a glass of ale, and then back they scramble on the Plymouth Mail. And the whip goes crack and the horn does blow. The turnpike calls and I must go. No wind, no sleet, no rain, no hail. We'll halt the driver of the Plymouth Mail. We roll across the Dorset Downs and stage once more in Shaftesbury Town. I crack my whip with might and main, and on we roll the Salisbury Plain. Soon over Hounslow Heath we fly, the gibbets loom against the sky, and the travellers they hide their gold, for fear we'll meet some robbers fall. And the whip goes crack and the horn does blow, the turnpike calls and I must go. No wind, no sleep, no rain, no hail. We'll halt the driver of the Plymouth Mail. By the sign of the standard in Cornhill, at last my rolling wheels are still, and the passengers all stiff and sore. Thank God our journey is safely o'er. In a cosy parlour now I stand, a goodly bumper in my hand, and the passengers raise a glass of ale to the health of the driver of the Plymouth Mail. And the whip goes crack and the horn does blow, the turnpike calls and I must go. No wind, no sleet, no rain, no hail. We'll halt the driver of the Plymouth Mail. The whip goes crack and the horn does blow, the turnpike calls and I must go. No wind, no sleet, no rain, no hail. We'll halt the driver of the Plymouth Mail.
John Simpson arrives in London. Turnkey from Norwich. What does he know about finding justice? Well, he knows how to ask. And soon, just like in the movies, though this is a true story, he gathers a crowd around him. They're amazed at the sight of this muddy turnkey nursing a baby. They're roused by the story he tells. And they tell him, go to the top. Go to the house of Lord Sidney, the Home Secretary.
Now when I came to London, having rode 200 miles, to see a turnkey nurse a baby caused a crowd to smile. But hearing its sad history, it made the crowd to groan, and many a worthy citizen swore justice would be done. Then up and spoke a gentleman and loudly did declare that only one man in the land could settle the affair. So to Lord Sidney's house I went, the crowd did follow on, for they swore they would see charity before the day was done. When we came to Lord Sidney's house, it was the hour of nine. We all came bursting in on him as he sat down to dine.
He listened to my story and his countenance was grave, then declared that ere the week was out, the family would be saved.
Lord Sidney wrote two letters and he signed them with his hand. One to Plymouth, one to Norwich, bidding them to understand
that young table and the baby with Susanna were to go
as a united family unto a distant shore.
Now I'm home again in Norwich, and some other trade I'll seek, as a coachman, a wagoner, a shopman or a sweep. Perhaps I'll take the shilling, go where the jacket blew. There's no trade, but it's the kinder, so lock some bars at you.
Thank you, John Simpson, our hero. We're now in Plymouth. Thanks to the work of John Simpson and Lord Sidney, the Home Secretary, Henry has been reunited with the baby, and together they have joined Susanna before she sets sail. A happy outcome. But Plymouth is not a happy place. Imagine you had been earmarked to travel to New South Wales. It must have felt like going to the other side of the moon. Or worse, at least you can see the moon. Few thought that they would return, especially when they saw the tiny boats that they would be sailing upon. The largest of these was only 114 foot long. Imagine a berth the size of a king-size bed, with a clearance of maybe 3.5 to 4 feet. And into this space would go 4 convicts in chains. It would be their home for 8 months of voyage. If that was not bad enough, there was a crook in charge of supplies. He falsified the flour. There was only enough for 2 slices of bread per day per convict. He also failed to include any musket balls. So on the outward leg to Rio, the Marines had to pretend that their guns were loaded. Even so, there was little that the convicts could try. Most had 14 pounds of iron riveted to their ankle. So who were these emigrants? They weren't the sort of people you might choose to join you on a desert island. There were few farmers, few fishermen, few builders, but they were young. The average age was 27. The same as within the Calais jungle camp. And like there, most of them were young men. Finally, on the 12th of May, 1787, at 3 o'clock in the morning, the fleet set sail. Today it would be like something out of science fiction. A band of guinea pigs beamed into outer space to colonize some distant galaxy. As they prepare to leave, this misfit band, they bid farewell to the green land of their birth.
Farewell to our lovers and our kind relations. Goodbye to the homes we love well. There is never an ending to our tribulations, for like sinners they've damned us to hell. Here's a Jew, here's a Jew to the green fields of England. Now we're parting from you.
The sweet fetters of love, they are wrenching asunder as they tear us from sweethearts and wives. And on some foreign shore we are sentenced to wander in exile the rest of our lives.
Here's a Jew, here's a Jew to the green fields of England. Now we're parting from you.
From Devon, from Derby, from Wiltshire and Wales, from Norwich and Newark and Frome, we are herded together from verminous jails, and like vermin are forced from our homes.
Here's a Jew, here's a Jew to the green fields of England. Now we're parting from you.
There's cheats and cut purses and rogues with no name. There's swindlers and sheep stealers bold. There's poor poaching fellows took nothing but game, and footpads took nothing but gold.
Here's a Jew, here's a Jew to the green fields of England. Now we're parting from you.
There's coiners and clippers and ladies of pleasure. There's dicers and drunkards and whores. There's butchers and bakers who dealt in short measures, and a few who have broken no laws.
Here's a Jew, here's a Jew to the green fields of England. Now we're parting from you.
There's some who expected to go to the scaffold. There's others who thought to go free. But now one and all in the hulks lie a shackle, and together must plough the salt sea.
Here's a Jew, here's a Jew to the green fields of England. Now we're parting from you.
There's some of our number are handsome and hearty. There's others the voyage will mend, but there's never a soul of our miserable party
we'll live to see England again. Here's a Jew, here's a Jew to the green fields of England. Now we're parting from you.
So farewell to all judges, so kind and forgiving. Farewell to your prisons and cells.
For though we must leave all that makes life worth living, we are leaving you bastards as well. Here's a Jew.
One-fifth of the First Fleet were women. What kind of voyage could they expect? Transport vessels tended to be ex-cargo ships. Fees were low, so the ships were old, the crews were poor. But still, the conditions were better than on slave boats. And they were better, too, than on the paid emigrant boats, for on those the captains paid in advance had little incentive to keep the cargo breathing. But still, the conditions were terrible. By the time they reached Rio, most of the women's clothing was so infested with lice, it had to be burnt. New clothes were fashioned for them out of rice sacks, which made the women yet more vulnerable to the advances of marines, crew, and other convicts. Many women had to make that terrible choice of whether to ally themselves with one strong man and so protect themselves against the predations of others. In this, as in so many other ways, their experience matches that of women in such transit today. The oldest woman aboard was 82. 19 women gave birth during the voyage. The first was Elizabeth Evans, just 1 week out from Plymouth, but she miscarried. But then soon thereafter, Isabella Lawson gave birth to a young girl. Once out of sight of land, all but the most troublesome convicts were unchained and allowed to exercise on deck, which helped to keep them alive. And what of Henry and Susanna? They were lucky. For much of the journey, they were able to travel with their child. But what could it have been like to be a family in such transit? Just like today, the families we see crouching on those inflatables, squatting outside tents in Jordan, or walking rail tracks in Macedonia. How does a family sustain its dignity under such conditions?
Across the still and the silent ocean, a ship she finds her way alone. The crew they make no loud commotion. The chained transports they make no moan. All black
black despair to lie behind us, and what awaits us no man may know. Of those dark days, naught can remind us. New worlds are waiting, to which we go.
As the sun set on the 19th of January, 1788, after 8 months of voyage, the ship sighted land. By 10 o'clock the next morning, they were safely anchored in Botany Bay. Thus ended one of the great sea voyages of history. Its leader, Captain Arthur Phillip, had steered the first fleet over 15,000 miles of ocean without losing a vessel and was losing few of those on board. He went on to become a wise, kindly governor to this infant society. He recognized that the best incentives for those emerging from chains are hope and opportunity. And he was famous for saying, "How do we know what humanity lies hidden beneath the rags and filth of a mangled life?" Henry was in the first boat ashore, and it's said that the captain was reluctant to get his feet wet. So Henry carried him ashore through the surf, a noble entrance upon the new land. 2 weeks later, Henry and Susanna were married, the first European wedding upon this new land. But thereafter, life proved harsh for the settlers. The land was barren, the supplies inadequate, the convicts incompetent, and the soldiers unruly. And let's not forget, they had stolen this land from those who already lived there. This motley group survived and thrived. Susanna raised 11 children. She became a founding mother to this infant colony. Henry became the first chief constable there and a businessman. Back in Britain, they faced little hope, but here they found ambition, and their ambition found reward. Where two families had been destroyed, a new family arose, and that family became one of the families of Australia. In 1988, on the site of the original colony just outside Sydney, at the 200th wedding anniversary of Henry and Susanna was celebrated by 500 of their descendants. And so come, all ye gentle people, who are lost in dark dismay, and remember that the blackest night must sometime yield to day. Remember that the wildest storm eventually must pass, and like Henry and Susanna, may you find your joy at last. So now we leave this band of settlers. They're on their own, thousands of miles from all they once knew. They still think they're British, but their only links to home are the small boats that brave the big oceans to reach them. The sailors on these transports are as rough as the seas they cross. They do not fear inundation, for they live to ride the waves. At a time when few travel, these sailors know the world well, and they sing of the world they cross And most of all, they can't wait to return to Plymouth and the women they've left behind.
Sweet ladies of Plymouth, we're saying goodbye. Roll down. We'll rock you and roll you again by and by.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down.
Away and the sails unfurled.
Roll down.
We're bound for to take her halfway round the world.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down.
Biscay, the seas will run high.
Roll down.
The poor sickly transports, they'll wish they could die.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down.
On the wild coast of Africa, it do appear.
Roll down.
The poor nervous transports, they'll tremble with fear.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down.
When the Cape of Good Hope, it is rounded at last.
Transports along for the past. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down.
When the great southern whales and our quarter the spout,
roll down.
Them poor simple transports will goggle and shout.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down.
And when we arrive off Australia's strand,
roll down.
The poor weary transports, they'll long for the land.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down. And we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down.
And when we set sail for old England shore,
roll down.
Poor stranded transports will see them no more.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down. And we will roll. And roll down.
Then, sweet ladies of Plymouth, we'll pay all your rent.
Roll down.
Go roving no more till our money's all spent.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down.
Plymouth, we're saying goodbye.
Roll down.
We'll rock you and roll you again by and by.
Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll down. Walk around, me brave boys, and roll down, and we will roll.
So Saul Rose leading that rousing sea shanty Roll Down as the finale to that strikingly original production of The Transports by Peter Bellamy. A tale of punishments and heartache, and yet also one of regeneration and hope. BBC Radio Theatre packed to the gallery with people relishing the musicianship and commitment of this cast. Peter Bellamy's original tale reworked by the writer Matthew Crampton, who you heard as the narrator, and the orchestrator Paul Sartin, ably assisted by all the musicians tonight. Sean Cooney, Rachel McShane, Nancy Kerr, Benji Kirkpatrick, Greg Russell, David Eagle, Michael Hughes and Saul Rose. And the cast getting a standing ovation here at the BBC Radio Theatre. And as Nancy Kerr, who has Australian roots, said recently, it's only actually relatively recently that Australians have felt able to talk about this subject of transportation. It used to be called the stain, she said, to have convict ancestry, but now it's got this dignity, importance and also a relevance to now. And folk song, as ever, proving a great vehicle with which the past can illuminate the present. So now, as the cast of The Transports 2017 take their final bows, I'll wish you a very good night from the BBC Radio Theatre here in London.
Verity Sharp, and the producer was Julian May. That performance of The Transports was recorded live for Radio 3 late last summer. Good evening, I'm Chris Barrow, and Peter Bellamy's folk ballad opera The Transports can perhaps be counted as part of the great English folk revival that happened in the 1960s and 70s. The importance of folk music in the broader sound world of composers cannot be underestimated, in particular in the music of the Hungarian composer Béla Bartók. As well as travelling around Hungary to collect old Magyar folk tunes, he often wrote works that are entirely based on folk tunes. The works we're going to hear next are an arrangement of Hungarian folk songs that formed the basis of Bartók's For Children Piano Suite. The violinist Tivadar Orsák took the nine pieces here and, more than simply transcribing them, arranged them from Bartók's suite. They're all identified by their tempo markings. Performing the Hungarian folk songs is the violinist James Enners and the pianist Andrew Armstrong. Thank you. Bartok's Hungarian folk songs for violin and piano, performed by James Enners on the violin and Andrew Armstrong on the piano. We're going back two centuries now to the music of Georg Philipp Telemann. The prolific composer, born in Magdeburg in Prussia, wrote more than 600 overture suites in his lifetime. We're going to hear the overture of one of those suites in D major. It's majestic and triumphant, and it's performed by the Academy for Alte Musik Berlin.
Thank you.
The Academy for Alte Musik Berlin performing one of Telemann's overture suites in D major. And Radio 3 in concert will be live from the Wigmore Hall tomorrow, featuring the Academy for Alte Musik Berlin and the Italian contralto Sonia Prina performing Baroque music. And now for details of another in concert.
Late works by 20th century masters. Janáček, Carter, Berg and Bartók. performed by Simon Rattle and the London Symphony Orchestra. With Isabel Faust as the soloist in Alban Berg's Violin Concerto. Radio 3 in concert. Next Tuesday evening at 7:30, and then available on the BBC Radio 3 website.
Good evening, I'm Chris Barrow, and this is BBC Radio 3. Now, here's Eleanor Rosamond Barraclough with Free Thinking.
Hello. It's that time of year. Holidays behind us or even ahead of us. One in three of us now take winter breaks, either to visit friends and family or just to find some much-needed winter sun. Which means planes, trains, departure lounges, station buffets, chilli platforms, coffee, endless bloody coffee, other people's children, tannoy announcements, checking the departures board or screen over and over again, too much fresh air, too much central heating, dry skin, desiccating air conditioning, fed up with partner, fed up with journey, fed up with life. Or maybe that's just me. But there is something about these neither here nor there places. Today on Free Thinking, we're talking about the in-between. Does it make us feel like this? How about this? Joining me to discuss the potential or otherwise of the in-between are the poet Vani Kapildeo, writer and walker Ian Sinclair, the artist Alexandra Carr, neuroscientist Dean Burnett, and philosopher Emily Thomas. Ian, you walk and write and write and walk. Have you got much experience of that waiting around feeling?
I really feel that I don't want to go anywhere you can't walk, but occasionally life means that you do, and you end up in the airport. And the thing about airports is that they're at the edge of town, whereas stations, railway stations, generally are at the centre. So the further away from the town you get, the less comfortable I am. And the airport is a difficult liminal space because now the whole world has become a kind of airport. Everything aspires to this sort of generic condition. Counter-terror meets retail counter. It's a kind of shopping experience you feel you must buy something as a superstition to get you through the journey. And now the universities, the hospitals, they all have this same sort of space. So it's a classic non-space, and it's not one I'm very comfortable with.
Emily, you have a particular yen for these sorts of places, don't you?
I do. I absolutely adore them, in fact, which I realise is unusual. lots and lots of writers have written about how simply dreadful they are. There's a great quote from a woman traveller in the 1800s where she says that the only thing train stations are united in is their ugliness.